Welcome to the Mum Break Podcast, a place where you can feel normal, get helpful information, and laugh your ass off. Hopefully without peeing your pants. I'm your host, Erica, and I have two kiddos. I am not a mom expert, but I do have a zillion hours of therapy under my belt and no filter. I'm on my own journey to find happiness, and I want to help you on the way to yours.
I am so, so, so excited about this week's episode. I cannot say and express how grateful I was for Tara to come on and so candidly share in such an eloquent way her amazing journey. And I know that while she shares it and while you're listening, you'll likely cry like I did. And she still is so positive and optimistic, and she is such a wonderful example to how to live your life, and I just loved it. So I will also say that this is the longest episode I've ever recorded by far. It's probably about three times the length of a normal episode, and I struggled with whether or not I should release it in multiple segments or just release it all in one. But you know what? Honestly, I was so enthralled when I was listening to her that I just wanted to hear more and more and more. And frankly, ultimately what the decision came down to was that if I had the bandwidth and the time and somebody made me stop listening halfway through and told me to wait till next week, I'd be pissed. So guys, full disclosure, my longest episode yet, and I think it is the best use of time. It is all about Tara's experience as a two-time double lung transplant recipient. And she tells us her story as she goes through and deals with living with cystic fibrosis. She's wonderful. We have been Instagram friends for years, and I'm so excited to give this platform over to her. You may notice that I've removed the ads for this episode. And the one thing I ask you guys to do is that instead of me putting ads in, please, 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 as you go through this episode, check out, and even while you're doing it, check out how to be a donor in your area. In Ontario, it's beadonor.ca. If you're in Canada, that website, beadonor.ca, has links to the other provinces. If you're in the States, you can Google it, because I'm not in the States. And just please take the time to go check it out. I signed up right after this episode to be an organ donor, and it quite literally took 90 seconds, and that was including my computer freezing in the middle of it. You just need your health card, and you just need to fill out a couple small forms, and that's it. So without further ado, we just jump into things here with Tara. I hope you love this episode and are moved by this episode as much as I was recording it.
I got door duty at work the other day and literally just like letting a certain number of people in. And at the end of the day, my boss is like, oh, thanks so much for doing that. Like, he's like, I know it's not the easiest part and you got to deal with people. I was like, you just paid me to work a full day and like talk to people. I didn't have to do any work. Like, are you kidding me? I will do door duty every day. Like,
yeah. So. Did you get many grumpy people?
It wasn't too bad.
Oh, yes.
Like, I mean, it was payout day for the reserve. So we were lined up because they didn't get the direct deposit information sent out on time, like the government or whatever. So some people were kind of like grumpy and it was like not a nice day out. But then some people were like super nice and funny. And like some of them were just like standing in line, like telling jokes. And I'm like a sucker for like dad jokes or like funny jokes. So like the one guy, he's like, what do you call a fish with no eyes? And I literally like thought about it for like 3 minutes. I was like, hey, like there's catfish. I'm like, it's not like dog fish. So I'm trying to be like blind fish. Like, yeah. And then he said that. And I literally howled. And I was just like, I'm embarrassed at how funny I found that, but I'm going to use that. Like,
oh my God, you would love my husband. The only reason I know the answer to that joke is because he tells it to Aubrey all the time. So
I was going to say, it's great for kids.
And that's why I know it, because Jordan literally just makes up jokes with her. And now Aubrey will make up random jokes too. And and we do a lot of the, you know, like, oh yeah, knock, knock.
Oh, yes.
Okay, you have to do it, though. Knock, knock.
Who's there?
The interrupting cow.
Interrupting cow.
Boo.
My cousin's kid does that, and he's like not quite old enough where he gets it yet, so he like messes them up, or like he'll say knock knock and you go, who's there, and he'll be like moo, and then you're like no, you forgot the line, and then he's like oh no, oh no, like but it's just so cute.
It's great because you can do it with any animal, so it goes on forever. So then we just start cycling through basically any animal that she knows, so it's like it lasts for a good half an hour. I mean,
That's when they can repeat back to you even, and they're learning their animal noises, and they're not
it's like I'm practically teaching her life skills.
I was gonna say, like, you're a teacher, you could be doing it.
Oh god.
And people like dad jokes like that, and simple kind of, like, my mom's whole family is very like dry sense of humor, and then really good at like puns and dad jokes. So I'm like, it just comes in the family, and I've accepted it, and I'm really good at it, so you know, like
okay. And now, like, about what we're planning to talk about, this ties in nicely because you have the best sense of humor and just like the sunniest attitude ever, considering everything that you've been through.
Yeah, I mean, you could ask people that are more involved in my life, and they're like, oh, she has her days.
Well, of course. But
no, for the most part, I think what like enables me to be that way is that being born with a genetic illness that resulted in needing the transplant and everything like that, was knowing, you know, like, I didn't know any different. Like, it was just, you go about life, and I woke up every morning, I had to do my meds, and then I could have breakfast with my sisters and brush my teeth, get ready for school, kind of thing. And my parents just tackled it like, that's Tara's life, that's what she does. Probably, I don't know if it was good or bad that I'm the oldest in like my mom and dad's family. Like, I have an older half sister, but being the first kid, like, they kind of just set the routine and whatever, and we rolled with it. And then we never hid anything either. Like, we weren't shy about the fact that I'd be sitting like doing a nebulizer, and like family friends would come over and they'd just be like, oh, hey, how's it going? Like, oh, just over here vaping up a thing. Like,
hey.
Yeah. But I think, like, obviously the sense of humor definitely comes from like my mom's side of the family. And just like, I don't personally see any other way of dealing with it. You could be completely negative and miserable and mopey, and not to say I haven't had like my days or weeks or months that I'm like that, when I'm just like, I quit, karma, you suck, like, yeah. But the universe is against me. But I think it's easier, like, in the moment I definitely get frustrated and upset and everything like that, and then I've gotten good at stepping back and then kind of evaluating and sharing things, especially running my Facebook page as like a blog for all my health stuff. So by the time I go and like, I find writing it out is almost therapeutic as well. So by the time I get to that point, I try not to do like in the moment stuff, unless it's one of those where I'm like, this is just so bad, it's ridiculous, and you can't not laugh, because what else are you gonna do? And there's like studies proving, you know, if you have a sense of humor and you're happier and you tackle things that way, or you can find a bright side or whatever, that, like, you know, you do better getting the same course of treatment as somebody else who's super mopey, negative, whatever. And some of it is, you know, mindset, and you can choose that way. And then some of it is, you know, you can have a shitty day, but you got to move forward.
I think that's super interesting though, because so I'm like, give me numbers, give me stats, give me like scientific proof.
Oh, and
it's cool that it's, there's research that being happier has better outcomes. And I think that could be applied for literally everything, right? Just,
oh, absolutely.
Insane. And yeah. It's so impressed. I'm just so impressed by your journey. Oh, I'm such a little stalker of your stuff.
Well, it's so funny because I was telling my mom that I was doing this podcast, and she's like, who is it with? And I'm like, well, Erica. And she's like,
Tara.
Who's Erica? And I'm like, oh, she like lives in Ottawa, she's got two kids, and blah, blah, blah. My mom's like, and how do you, like, what? I was like, I don't know. Instagram one day, like, I think it was when I was nannying, and, you know, I was looking at stuff, and then I probably found your profile because you do mom stuff. But it was just one of those, I'm like, I don't know, I just like attached to her kid. This one, like, Aubrey was teeny tiny too,
she
right?
She was so sweet. Well, sort of.
She's just going through the phases of life. We all do it. Yeah. But yeah, because even like the twins that I nannied, they're 3 and a half now.
What? Okay, that blows my mind. Mm-hmm.
I was over there last weekend. We were decorating their Christmas tree together. That's going to be like our annual tradition now. Like Auntie T comes over and decorates the tree, and like they're just chatting away and running around and like playing hide and seek and all this. And I'm like, I used you to hold both babies. Of you in both of my hands, like. So, life has gone by too quick.
It is insane. And I know they say that it goes by quickly, but it really does.
It is like the days drag on, I find. But then all of a sudden you're like, where did the last 5 years go? And I find that I keep track of like my life in terms of like medical like timeline sort of. So I'll be like, oh, well, it happened right after I had the second transplant, like a year after that. So it'd be around this date. And like people are like, what? Like, how do you, and I'm like, I don't know, like, that's, my life is based, because it's been the last decade, really, mm-hmm. because I grew up super healthy with cystic fibrosis. I went to clinic, I took my meds, and I didn't have any issues, really, you know, so it wasn't a sole focus for me.
It was until the last decade. How old are you, by the way?
27.
27, okay.
Yeah.
So, okay, maybe, can you tell people, just, like, at a high level, who you are, and why you're here, and then I was hoping that you can just sort of share your story or whatever you're comfortable sharing. And I know that's quite a lot because you're quite transparent with your journey.
Synopsis.
Yeah. And I really want to talk about organ donation too, and then how people can set up to donate. Mm-hmm. It's such an easy thing to do.
Yeah.
But so who are you? Why are you here? Other than the fact that your mom, like, shout out to your mom. Yeah. Tara's on a random mom blogging.
It's stranger danger.
Watch out for the white.
All virtual. It's good.
It's fine. Although I was like, come on over to my house when you're visiting.
Oh my god. Well, and I was so excited because we were gonna be like at Parliament and doing stuff, and I was like, I'm gonna be in town, like as if it's like the smallest town. Like, yeah.
No. It's like, I'll bring my children to meet this internet stranger.
Yeah. It is weird times we live in. You go back a few decades and it's like, don't get in a car with someone. And now it's like, yeah, I've met you online. I'll meet up with you.
Sure.
So I am Tara Burke and I have cystic fibrosis. And as a result of that, I have undergone 2 double lung transplants over the last 8.5, 9 years now. And I am here to discuss the importance of organ donation and how it's impacted my life and how I went from being unintentionally ignorant about organ donation. I never really crossed my mind as something that happened, let alone something that would be happening to myself. And once I got involved in it, I started meeting other people who have been affected by transplant, whether it was lung or liver or kidney. And just the more I've learned about it, the more I want to promote how awesome it is, especially with the outcomes of my 2 transplants, even though I rejected the first one. They both have given me a quality of life that was unimaginable from beforehand, because even when I was at my healthiest, I still didn't have healthy, normal functioning lungs because of cystic fibrosis. So to have that transplant and kind of take those first few breaths, even right after surgery, when you're still on a lot of meds and it's uncomfortable and sore. And then, cat, he's psycho this morning.
We all kind of are right now.
I let him do his thing. But I lost my train of thought.
Your first breath after surgery.
Oh, yes. It was right across the computer. Where's your toys? So from the first few breaths after surgery to, you know, being able to walk up a flight of stairs and not be completely winded, and, you know, doing simple household chores even, and realizing like they're not marathons, and just kind of having a glimpse at what normal life is like, I guess, healthy lung normal life. No one really has a normal life, and I still have a lot of medical stuff that I have to keep track of and everything, but it's a lot easier now being able to breathe. You know, funny, it's kind of important. And then it's given me the opportunity as well to get out there, and I've been giving speeches and talking with different groups of people from university students to chiropractic unions and businesses, and kind of just sharing, you know, the importance of organ donation, because I think the biggest struggle with organ donation is the lack of donors. And it really just comes down to the fact that it's not well promoted, per se. Like I said, I had no idea it was really a thing. I mean, you heard of it if you watched Grey's Anatomy, stuff like that. You know, you read about it in a book, but it was never something you thought actually happened to people, let alone young people or anyone that you knew, kind of thing. So that was kind of the biggest eye-opener, I know, for myself and my family and my friends. So now we're all kind of big advocates for it, and signing up is so easy, and it has such a huge impact. Like, there's one donor could save up to 8 lives and impact the lives of 75 others if you were registered as a full organ donor and skin and tissue donor. So I've taken a few training courses with Trillium Gift of Life, who is in charge of all the organ donation coordination within Ontario. And they kind of have helped, you know, kind of bust some of the myths and educate you in how to approach the topic. And, you know, if people are interested and they have questions, it's someone that I can direct them to. And they've kind of educated me as well on how to respond and stuff like that. So I've become an advocate through them. And I really enjoy, you know, talking with people and getting up and sharing this story and having them look at me now and seeing some healthy, normal looking person. And then you throw a picture up on the slideshow behind you, and there's someone who looks like me, obviously, in a sense, but doesn't at all. And then explaining that, you know, brushing my teeth was like running a 400 meter sprint, which is something I used to do in elementary school. Like, you know, things like anything, as soon as you raise your hands, brushing your hair, trying to reach into a cupboard, the amount of effort it takes to breathe and do anything above kind of heart level, and different things like that, that you don't think about until somebody points it out that you are using energy. It's like if you just worked out and then you go to grab something the next day and you're like, oh, that's a sore muscle. Like, didn't know that was there. So it's still mind blowing to me that they can take organs from one person and put them in somebody else and they work. Like, I find science is super interesting and fascinating, and I love all of it. It's still, I wake up some days and I'm like, oh, I gotta do my treatments, which usually would take sometimes like hour and a half, and then I can start getting ready for the day, and then I'm like, oh no, I don't have to. Because for the first 18 years of my life, it was, you know, wake up, do your meds, do that, and that was my routine, that was my normal. I didn't know any different, so it's kind of incredible.
So for those who don't know, can you just give us a high-level overview? Like, what is cystic fibrosis and how does it affect the body?
Cystic fibrosis is a genetic disorder. So basically, both of your parents have to have this faulty CFTR gene. And if you have one copy of the gene, you're just a carrier. So there's no symptoms, no side effects or anything like that. And then if you go on to have children with two individuals that carry it, there's a 25% chance that your child has CF. So I'm the only person in my family that has cystic fibrosis, and I have two younger sisters by the same parents. Both of them are carriers, because now that they're getting older, they've done the testing for going forward if they're going to start family planning or anything like that. But it mainly impacts your lungs and your digestive system. So basically, it's the sodium chloride or the salt channel in your body doesn't function properly. Depending on what mutation you have, it can function at 50% or it doesn't function at all, or there's different variations and everything. But it basically makes it so that the fluid in your body that, you know, protects your organs and helps blood travel and everything move around and be happy, it makes it more of like a sticky mucus. So it often plugs parts of your lungs and creates infection, because it's a good breeding ground for anything to stay in. My pancreas doesn't produce the proper enzymes to digest food and break it down and get the nutrients from it. So I have to take those enzymes via pills every time I eat anything. There's like CF related diabetes, which same thing if your pancreas doesn't produce insulin. And there's over 2000 mutations of this CFTR gene. Wow. So there literally is no one case that is the same. And I even have a friend who has her and her sister, same parents, have CF. She has had 2 double lung transplants now, like myself. And her sister has only ever had a handful of hospitalizations with IV and is completely healthy. So wow. Even with the exact same mutations, it depends on how your body kind of adapts and works with it. So there's people with CF that only have lung issues. Some only have digestion. Some have none. And there are some people who have not been diagnosed until they were in their late 30s or 40s. And they were always told maybe they had asthma or something like that, or, you know, irritable bowel syndrome instead. And then suddenly they found out. So an exciting thing was that, I believe it was 2 years ago now, all of Canada now includes cystic fibrosis in newborn screening.
Wow.
So it's one of those. Water. Yeah. Because 1 in 25 Canadians has this faulty CF gene.
Wow, that's so high.
Mm-hmm. And you wouldn't know it because you're asymptomatic if you just have the one copy. Mm-hmm. And even if you had parents that both had the copy, it's a 50% chance that you're just a carrier. And the other 25 is that you're not a carrier and you don't have CF. So I always joke, I was the lucky 25% there. And hey. Everyone's like, go buy a lotto ticket. And I'm like, well, I'm not that kind of lucky.
But doesn't work that.
Yeah. So it's fascinating. Like, and my mom is very into genealogy. Yeah. And so is my dad. So we've kind of gone back and we've been able to trace like, oh, you know, my mom's great, great grandma had a bunch of children and say maybe 3 of them died at a young age of respiratory illness or pneumonia, which could have been cystic fibrosis, but because it's a fairly new disease, Cystic Fibrosis Canada, who funds a lot of the research and runs a lot of the awareness programs and stuff like that. I work closely with them as a volunteer, and that organization will be turning 60 in 2021. So this coming year, which is super exciting. And it was in 1989 that they discovered the CF gene as the cause of this illness.
Oh, wow.
So basically, when people were having children, and if they were kissing their forehead or whatever, and if they felt or tasted salty, that was kind of like a diagnosis of something is wrong. And it wasn't until like more recently, and it was actually at SickKids in Toronto, that they discovered the specific CFTR modulator gene as the root cause for CF. So we have salty skin. So if you've really worked out and you got salt crystals everywhere and stuff, yeah, like sometimes we just are more like that on a day-to-day basis. especially if you live somewhere humid, it's awful. It's like a face scrub every day. So there's like different things like that, but now it's exciting that it's part of newborn screening because there's even like in womb or in utero tests that can be done if there is a concern, and they kind of know like what to watch for. When I was born, so I wasn't diagnosed until I was 14 months old because it was not part of newborn screening in 93. So when I was born, I had that, ileus meconium.
Like you pooped on yourself?
Exactly. Yeah. Like you had pooped and you had inhaled it or whatever. So I was in the incubator for a few days. That is a common sign of potential for cystic fibrosis because the digestive system is kind of wonky and a few other things. But basically that happened and then nothing for a while. And then when I was just over a year, like my parents noticed I was coughing a lot and it was super mucousy, phlegmy. But I didn't have any other symptoms of being sick. And like, they just kept taking me to the doctor. And then finally they did a sweat test, which came back as positive for cystic fibrosis. And then they do blood work and genetics and stuff like that. So I'm also lucky in that I have 2 rare mutations. So one of them was not even officially labeled until further along in my life. So I do have like the names of both of them now.
That's neat though, science-y wise.
It's very cool. Like, and just what they've done in the last
short period of time.
It's insane. And it's exciting to be a part of, because whether I'm doing fundraising or advocating or just giving a speech or whatever, I'm seeing the actual progress happening even in the span of just my lifetime. And with it being such a newly diagnosed and discovered the cause of and treatments and stuff, the differences in even technology of compressors for inhaling your meds. And I mean, my medications used to take at least an hour every day. And I have friends now who are like, oh yeah, like just Tobra takes me 5 minutes. And I'm like, that was 45 minutes for me. I'm like, what the heck? Like, so to see it come that far, and it makes it so you can live a bit more normally, and you're not spending your whole day doing medications. And I like look back on it, and I have no idea how in high school I did my meds 3 times a day. So I was at least a half hour, if not more. And if you were sick, you know, you'd add an extra fourth treatment in sometimes. And, but I was in band in high school, so we had before school practice. Wow. And I played volleyball as well, so we had after school practice and games. And I did fairly well in school. I liked school, so I enjoyed studying and everything. And I look back on that and I'm like, how did I have time in my day to do everything? Whereas now when I take a handful of pills morning and night, and that's all I have to do. Wow. And I still find that I run out of time in a day and I can't get myself up out of bed in the morning when the alarm goes off. And I'm like, I don't know how I used to do that.
Netflix didn't exist back then.
Oh, I know. Well, and I think I didn't know any different. So it was normal for me to have to get up an hour before I needed to start getting ready to go to school for anything. I always found it funny. My music teacher in grade 9, I played French horn in music class.
Of course you did. Something that involves lungs. You couldn't play violin or something.
No. So I played French horn because they needed French horn people in band, and I absolutely hated it. So myself and the other guy he made play French horn, we had convinced him to let us learn to play trumpet as well. So we learned trumpet on Fridays and French horn, and your final exam, I will never forget, you had to hit this high F on the French horn, and I kid you not, like, I thought I was going to blow a lung trying to do it, but I hit it, and I was so proud of myself. Huge. And it wasn't until I was going on the band trip in grade 11, so this was grade 9 music, grade 11, we were going to New York, and you have to fill in the full form from your parents to go away on the trip, and your medical stuff, and everything like that, and I remember my music teacher came up to me, and he was like, I had no idea you had CF. He's like, if I had known that, I never would have made you play French horn. Like, I would have given you something different. And I was like, are you kidding? I just had to play the medical card to get out of that. Like, but it was something that never crossed my mind, because my parents treated it as, you know, you do you. Like, growing up, I played sports. I did soccer, gymnastics. Like, I got into volleyball and basketball and everything. And it was, you know, if you can do it, you do it. If you need to catch your breath, step aside, catch your breath, and you keep going. Like, they didn't force me to do anything, but they just treated me no different than any other child, which I think is what set me up for doing so well, like mentally, mm-hmm. in handling everything, because I wasn't someone who sat at home and was all like, whoa, woe is me, I'm sick. And I never thought of myself as sick. And I never hid it. Like, at school, I'd be taking my meds in the cafeteria and people be like, oh, what's that? And I'm like, well, they're enzymes. Like, my stomach just doesn't produce them themselves, so I have to take it. And they're like, cool, can I have one? And I'm like, yeah, because your body literally produces it, so it's just gonna digest your food. Like, it's nothing fun. Like,
not that exciting.
Yeah, no, but I had my healthiest year. Cat, he's like attacking the computer.
How many pets do you have?
Sorry, so I have my cat here with me, Eddie. And then Eric has the 2 dogs at his place.
Got it. Okay.
Because we've recently separated. So I'm in an apartment right now. So the goal is once I get into like a house with, like, this is short term. Once I'm in a house with a yard and everything, we'll kind of alternate with the dogs and everything. Switch so them. Between the two of us, we've got 3. And I swear that this cat is a dog, the way he acts. So
for people who can't see, he's just literally running across the keyboard back and forth. Just like, play with me, mom.
Yeah, spend time with you're me. Still home. This is awesome.
Why are you here? Mom blogging podcast. So you say you had your healthiest year.
So my healthiest year was grade 11. I had taken part in, I always did a bunch of research studies and tried different medications and things like that, just because I found it interesting. My dad was interested in a lot of the stuff. And if I was going to be doing treatments and medications anyways, why not try something new? And if it worked. So I was in a trial at that point that I absolutely hated. It was literally a vial and you were inhaling this like sugar and med component. Seriously, Kat, that made you cough like the first few times I did it, to the point of like puking. And I absolutely hated it. But once you got used to it and consistent, it ended up making me the healthiest I had been. My lungs were awesome. But unfortunately, the study ended, and so did the extended study, and I had to stop doing that medication. So that is our guess as to why, like, I was doing so well, and then seemingly out of nowhere, my lung function just started to plummet. I wasn't really sick. Nothing had happened that was out of the ordinary, you know, no infection or anything like that. And come exams of winter semester for grade 12, the team was like, why don't we put you in hospital for a 2-week tune-up? It's super common for people with CF. You know, you come in, we give you IV meds, we try and put some weight on you, we do extra in-person physio, and you know, you work with the team on a regular basis, and we can play with some combinations, look at meds and everything. I had only ever been in hospital maybe 3 times before that, so I was 17 at this point. And some people with CF did routine checkups and tune-ups in hospital. So some people go in every 4 months as a routine. They do IV meds for a week or two and then they head out. So that was kind of foreign for me. So I remember on my second date with Eric that I was like, so by the way, I'm going to be in hospital for a couple of weeks, but it's no big deal because it's just a tune-up and most people with CF have to do it. I just haven't done it until now. So little did we know, almost to the day, a year later, I was transplanted.
Wow.
So at that point, my lung function just started to plummet. I stayed at the London Victoria Hospital for that first day for 2 weeks. Got home. I was then using oxygen overnight. I was on IV fairly consistently. So I had a PICC line in, which is like a permanent IV that I was able to do IV meds at home. So I could still go to school and do all of that because I was super focused on still graduating and finishing all my classes. So the day after prom in May, I was sent off to SickKids. So we kind of worked around my schedule of there's no way I was missing prom. They sent me to SickKids for a month-long stay. And basically my pediatric doctor had said, I want to send you to Toronto. They have access to more tests, more medications, different ideas. You know, it's a fresh set of eyes to look at your entire case, see if there's anything they can do to maybe get your lung function up a bit, make you more stable. So I was in there for about a month. I was on oxygen full time pretty much at that point. I eventually weaned off of it. They did a bunch of tests. And one of my favorite ones I like to talk about is, it was like this, astronaut. I always want to say alien. Astronaut helmet, and you're laying in bed and they put this helmet on and they say you need to lay still, no like laughing, no talking, no nothing. Just breathe, and you do that for about like 10 minutes and then it runs a bunch of calculations and stuff like that. And it tells you how many calories you would burn in a 24-hour period if you were to strictly breathe and do nothing else.
Mm-hmm.
So those results came back that I would need to intake 4,000 calories a day to maintain my weight if I was just breathing. So at that point, it was kind of like, you know, how can we squeeze more calories in? Maybe we should put a feeding tube in. And I was like, no, not having it. I'll just eat more food. That's fine. So like food became medicine for me. There was like an alarm that went off every half hour. Like, oh, time to eat something, have a snack. And the funny thing about being a CF kid born in the 90s is back then there was no such thing as like healthy fats. Mm-hmm. So the dietitians literally told my parents, like, give her McDonald's. You know, if she's eating an apple, make sure she dips it in peanut butter or caramel or like, You know, if I was eating something that would be healthy and a good snack for kids, my parents would be like, are you going to have a cookie with that? Like, because I needed the calories and I was burning them and breathing. So that test was kind of cool. And then that was the first time transplant was ever mentioned to me. And I remember them saying something along the lines of, hopefully we can get a plan sorted out so that you don't end up having to list. But we think it is more likely that you're going to end up needing a transplant. And I was like, a what? And then they were like, oh, it's never been brought up to you before that like transplant is a treatment option, not a cure and not a fix, a treatment option for end stage CF in your lungs. And I remember it was like all these words were just kind of flying at me. And I was in hospital by myself with having two younger sisters. I had agreed with my parents that, you know, they stayed home during the week and then they came to visit me on weekends and we hung out. And it didn't make sense for somebody to literally sit in a hospital room with me when I was 17, old enough to occupy myself. And I'm busy enough between nurses and dietitian and physio and sick kids hooks you up with, you know, Xbox and the Wii and all the different games and stuff. So I was like, you know, why would I need you to sit here when you guys can be home with my sisters and stuff? So I was there by myself when they brought it up. And I remember I called one of my best friends, Danny, and I told her, and I was just like, I don't even know what to think. And like, it doesn't make any sense. And like, I'm not that sick. Like I didn't see myself as sick ever. And she's like, oh, well, they said maybe, right? So let's hope all the meds work and whatever. And we brushed it under the rug as like, yeah, we'll give a try to everything. So I got out of sick kids. I graduated and I ended up going off to the University of Guelph that September. So this is 2011. So I went off to the University of Guelph and I was roommates with a friend from high school, actually that I'd known since elementary school. And at that point I was back to oxygen just overnight. And they had said, you know, watch your levels. If you're feeling tired or whatever, put oxygen on during the day. Here's a canister or whatever. But they didn't really tell me, you know, here's how to check if you need it. Mm. So walking to and from class was freaking exhausting. And I always joked like, oh, I hate going to this building because there's a hill along the way. And my roommate was like, what hill? There's no hill there. And I was like, there's definitely a hill. Like I could notice the slightest incline. And I've gone back to Guelph since and visited. And I'm like, yeah, it's an incline. It's not a hill. But, you know, so I had my first adult clinic in Toronto. So then I had moved from small town London, and I live in smaller town Sarnia, to Toronto. And we went to clinic there. And the Toronto CF clinic is the largest clinic in Canada. And I showed up to that appointment. My dad came with me. And the doctor there, I remember Dr. Tullis said to me, she goes, I can't let you leave clinic today. You are the sickest patient that we have in our clinic right now. And I was like it blew my mind. I was like, what do you mean I'm the sick? I'm the healthiest in clinic. You know, like just a year ago, like all my doctors were saying I'm so healthy and I, you know, I was doing great. So that was October 10th. And I stayed in hospital at St. Mike's Hospital for 2.5 months, pretty much.
Oh my God.
Again, more IV, some physio, did a lot of tests, stuff like that. And that's when they were really pushing for me to list for lungs. And I still wasn't to the point of realizing how sick I was. I look back at photos and at the situation and I'm like, how did I not realize?
You looked sick.
Yeah, but yeah, it like, is we'll amazing.
It's on her Facebook page. I'll link it up because yeah, the person I see now is mm-hmm. a completely different person than like even what, 2 years ago?
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Totally different.
Like I weighed about 70 pounds and I'm 5'5". Like mm-hmm. I'd always been thin though, because we are technically malnourished because our digestive system doesn't work proper, but that was my normal. So that was again where it was good. That was my normal, but it was also a flaw. And your body is amazing in that it can adapt to many things. So I got used to functioning at low lung function. So this point was, I was at maybe like 16% lung function. Oxygen full time. I was sleeping with a BiPAP machine, which is a big face mask that forces air in and essentially is doing the breathing for you so you can actually rest. And the team said, you really need to list now because with transplant and organ donation, there's no, like, you don't book a surgery day. you have to get on the list and you have to wait for a match to come in. And I remember saying to them, I'm like, so I'm an adult clinic now and I can make my own decisions, right? And I right away, my parents were like, oh dear. And I said, so I have to move to Toronto to wait on this list because you have to be close to the hospital. And I was like, but it's almost Christmas. And my parents have a Christmas Eve open house every year. And I've like, we always do it. And I love Christmas. So I want to be home for Christmas. And the team was like, you know, we don't really recommend that, but you can do as you please, kind of, you know. So I went home for Christmas. And it was actually going home for Christmas and attending our Christmas Eve party that made me realize how sick I was. I could not do the stairs up to my bedroom in my family home I'd grown up in. If I was coming downstairs, like when I woke up in the morning, I made sure I had everything with me that I needed to bring down because I was not going back up until I had to. I was on oxygen full time. So we had like a 20-foot hose that we had connected to a compressor and I was like a dog with a leash and, you know, my sisters or my parents, literally they'd be walking around and I could tell if they'd step on the hose by accident and I'd get jerked back and they're like, oh, sorry. Like, but it was also like, oh, where's Tara? We'll just follow the line. Like, but this open house is a bunch of family friends. I'll come over. It's social. It's awesome. I love talking. And I was miserable the entire day. I was exhausted. I didn't want to talk to people. I just felt crappy. And that was when I started to realize, okay, maybe I am a little sick. It still was not to the full extent, but, you know, showering was just, I pretty much gave up on showering. My sisters and my mom would help wash my hair in the sink. I could stand in the shower to rinse off, but there was no washing my hair. It was, try doing that with oxygen line and an IV line, and it just, it wasn't happening. That's when I realized I couldn't function at home normally. And okay, maybe this transplant thing would be okay. But again, they give you a lot of statistics that are not necessarily encouraging for transplant. But they have to tell you, you know, this is a big surgery and there are problems. You're trading one disease in your lungs for another. There's complications that can happen on the surgery table. You're very underweight. So there's a risk you may never come off the table. Try and put some weight on, like different things like that. But it got to the point where I just felt so crappy that I was like, all right, whatever treatment is going to work, let's do it. Because, well, if your alternative is dying, you may as well give it all a try. So I ended up catching an infection while I was home for Christmas. So I was back in hospital again for a couple weeks. And then I listed for lungs. And I was listed very high priority because of how sick I was. Down to like 70 pounds, 16% lung function. The average person is 80% or higher. I couldn't do anything. I was doing nothing. And I got a call for lungs 11 days after listing, which is almost unheard of. But because I was high priority, it was pretty much first set that came in was that matched was mine. So to match up for organ donation, it's your blood type. So they wean the list down that way. And then they look at the antibody panels, the size of the lungs, and then who's been on the list longer and who is sickest. So that's how they kind of weed through everybody that's listed. So that surgery was, I want to say 9 hours, which was typical, normal. Recovery was awesome. Like I was awake within a day. The breathing tube was out. I was up in a chair 2 days after I was out of like serious ICU within 3 days on the step down unit. Like everything was awesome. There were a few little blips here and there, but nothing that was a big issue. And I recovered. You stay in Toronto for 3 months. You do a physio program. They watch you closely. They monitor your medications because they put you on meds that suppress your immune system. So that your body does not discover the lungs and see it as a foreign object and attack them.
Okay.
So you have to stay in Toronto for the first 3 months and then they monitor very closely for the first 2 years. And once you hit that 2 year mark, it's kind of like the, okay, your meds are stable. The lungs are happy. Everything looks good. We can start seeing you once a year and you just do blood work and lung function locally. You know, if you're having an issue, give us a call. So I went back to school, University of Guelph. Things were great. And I was doing my home lung function test. And this was October, end of October of 2013. And my lung function
at that point,
yeah, My lung function at that point was up to 90%.
Wow.
I was a normal student living back at school. I was loving life. Like, I could go out and have fun. I was playing intramural volleyball.
Didn't notice the incline up the...
No, yeah, I'm like, haha, that's funny. I thought that was a hill. Like, but it was kind of, that was an eye-opener too of like, wow, I was really sick if I couldn't do that. And I did my home test and it registered at 50%. And I was like, well, that's weird. I feel fine, no symptoms or anything like that. I called the team. They sent me to the Guelph Hospital to do a test. They're like, maybe your machine's dying or whatever. 50% there as well. So they brought me into Toronto, did a bronchoscopy, checked on things, said they're not seeing any sign of rejection, but we'll run a few treatments and see what's happening. So I did two different attempts at treating rejection. One is basically a steroid bolus. So they pump you full of prednisone through an IV, which prednisone is a medication we have to take all the time. But you get it through an IV at like quadruple the dose you usually get. And roid rage is a thing. I was starving. I had restless legs. Like, it was, I was not fun to be around. And we tested lung function after 4 weeks of that and letting it do its thing. I was down to 40%. We did another treatment that was plasmapheresis. So that was looking at the antibodies in my blood. So they thought maybe I had caught a cold and my body had developed new antibodies to fight that cold. And those antibodies were fighting the lungs. So I did a treatment where they put some lines in you and they filter your blood and they remove the antibodies, put it back in. Lung function dropped down to 30%. So it was at that point, so March of 2014, that they said, you know, you are officially in chronic rejection and the only fix for this is another transplant. So I was 22 months post when I went into this rejection stint and I was like, I was so close. So the rejection was harder to deal with than being CF lungs and the first transplant. Like, the first one, I knew nothing going into it. I was like, if this is what I have to do, it's what I have to do. Like, I'd like to stay alive. So yeah, March 2014, we did all the tests to list me again. And they're like, if we can keep you stable, we don't have to list you right away, because the goal is to try and keep the lungs lasting as long as you can, because it's not guaranteed that another set is going to work any longer than this one. There's no, like, transplant is still a new science as well. So they're learning every day. So I like to say I lived in limbo land for about 4 years there of, I was too sick to really be working or back in school. Like, I had to move back home, but I was not sick enough to be listed for lungs. So I ended up going to the local college, and I got a business marketing degree there. And then I just kind of hung out at home. I slept, I woke up to eat, and I just had zero energy. And that was the hardest, like, mental struggle for myself, was I looked fine and I felt fine, but it was as soon as I got up to move, I couldn't breathe. So it was as if my lungs were slowly, like, turning into cement. So the airways were being scarred and attacked, and they literally were not functioning to open or close to breathe. So I stayed at that 30% level for almost, like, about, what do we want to say, like, to another 2 years. So I was 4 years out. And that's when, like, I finally said, you know, I had finished school. I could not do anything else. And I am a very, like, type A goal oriented. I need to be doing things. I enjoy it.
Like, you played two instruments that involve breathing with.
Yeah. You know, like, I don't like sitting around doing nothing.
While playing volleyball.
Yeah, exactly. You know, may not have been the smartest thing, but hey, it was like doing physio for my lungs. So it was awesome.
Totally fine.
So that's when we did the testing again. So I listed for lungs the second time, May of 2016. And I was somewhat stable, but I was dropping below that 30% line. And I just finally said, you know, the decision to list for a second is very different than the first. The first, you're sick, you'll have it. The second, not everybody will qualify for a second transplant. You have to be very, like, a good patient, per se. Like, you have to prove you take your meds, like, you will take care of yourself. You're in a good place mentally. Like, what's your reasoning for wanting another one? Why are you, like, what's wrong with current life situation? And it's a lot more based on quality of life versus the quantity of the numbers of your lung function, your weight, all of that, because again, it's not guaranteed, and the second surgery is harder, and there's a lack of organs available, so they offer, it's almost like they offer it to everyone for the first round, but if you need it again, it's a little bit harder to qualify, per se, unofficially. But so that was when I finally said, you know, I cannot sit around doing nothing. I had adopted our golden retriever when I first went into rejection because I had a month of like severe depression where I didn't get out of bed. I was doing nothing. Like I had no motivation. I was not myself. And my boyfriend and I at the time were like, you know, we talked about getting a dog, and he's like, well, why don't we do that? Because you have to get up to feed the dog and let them out. And then who doesn't love a puppy? So yeah. To cope with my depression, we got a puppy, which I don't necessarily recommend, but it worked for me. So yeah, we had Carrie, my golden at that time. And along the way, we had also then adopted a second dog that was a rescue. So Ellie, she's our shepherd collie, something mixed. And that was when I was going to school because I felt bad leaving Carrie home alone by herself because she was used to me being around all the time. She just looked mopey. Goldens look mopey when they lay down. So
they do. They look so sad.
Yeah. She didn't necessarily need another dog, but they're awesome. So we love them. But I decided I couldn't do anything and I wasn't going to sit around doing nothing at the age of 22, 23. Like I just was fed up with being in this limbo land of nothing. I had to be in Toronto at least once a month for doing tests and assessments, and they were following me closely. And, you know, I found I was driving up to Toronto, doing all the tests, coming home. It was taking like a week to recover from that because everything was exhausting. And then, you know, ta-da, you're back at Toronto again. So I had wrote my exams like the end of April, and literally the next day drove up to Toronto to move there for a month. So things had changed a little bit that you have to move to Toronto for a month to do physio and the initial tests and assessments, everything, make sure you're set up. And then you were allowed to live at home as long as you were within a like 3 to 5 hour radius, depending on where you lived, because new technology had come available. Which one of them for lungs is called the ex vivo machine. So my first transplant, I was part of the study for this machine, and it is basically a dome that they put the donor lungs in, hook it up to blood and oxygen and everything like that, and the lungs stay alive in this dome, and the doctors are able to go in and examine them. They can give antibiotics, they can do little biopsies, they can test everything. So it's making more lungs available because they're able to test it and say if they find, you know, a little issue here, they can
fix it,
perform a surgery on it and fix it, which is amazing. So my first surgery, my surgeon, Dr. Seipel, actually, I was in the study for that. So my lungs were part of that ex vivo study. And now they use it for every transplant for lungs, which is really cool. It's like similar to heart in a box, but it's like lungs in a dome. And it was discovered by Dr. Keshavji, who works at the Toronto Hospital.
Whoa,
which like blows my mind that there's a Canadian who did all of this, and he's in my hospital. Like, so my Dr. Seipel worked closely with him. And in Canada, there's only 4 centers that transplant lungs, and Toronto's the only one that does high risk lungs and double lung for the most part. So you have Vancouver, Edmonton, Toronto, and Montreal. Pretty much everybody has to go to Toronto. So I'm lucky that I live close to Toronto and I didn't have to move provinces across the country to list for lungs. But I did that, lived in Toronto for the month, and then I came home and I ended up waiting 2 years, 2 months before I got. So I got to experience both ends of the spectrum. Like, yeah, they give you the average wait time, they say, is 6 to 9 months or 9 to 12 months, depending on how many people are listed. So yeah, first time 11 days, it was like, I was hardly even listed. And second time, like I was losing hope that I was even actually listed. I received a false call March of 2018. So I was called, told there were lungs available, come to Toronto, you know, super exciting. I was very like unprepared because it had been waiting so long that I really felt like I wasn't even listed. So of course it was like calling all my family, getting everyone there. We figured it all out. And literally within 5 minutes of when I was supposed to be rolled down to the OR, they called it off because one of the lungs was no good. So they ended up doing a single lung transplant that day on someone else, but I have to have double because of cystic fibrosis. And once you've had both done, you have to have both again. Otherwise the rejection would just attack the other lung. So that was in March, which I wasn't super upset about. Most people were like, oh, that would have been even worse than like not getting a call. And I was like, not really, because now I know I am on the list and I know I'm towards the top of it. So like that kind of,
you're like, it's like you're moving up the line.
Yeah. So that kind of gave me some reassurance that I was like, okay, it's going to be soon. Mm-hmm. And then this is when I always joke that, you know, I have bad luck, if any, and I always prep for the worst going into clinic and everything like that, because then any result better than that, great. And that was my coping techniques, which, you know, my therapist might not say were the healthiest, but it got me through. So, I then got a call for lungs the second time, on a Sunday morning. It was July 22nd. So I was turning 25 on July 23rd. And every year we did like a backyard barbecue bonfire around my birthday / let's just all hang out kind of thing. So I had planned a big birthday for myself, a party for the Saturday, you know, and a lot of people were like, oh, sorry, like I won't be able to make it this year. I'm busy. I'm working. I'm doing this. And I was actually getting like super pissed off about it. I'm like, guys, 25 is a big deal. And for me, like, I'm big on birthdays because I'm like, I was alive another year. Like, yeah. Birthdays are cool.
I made it one more year.
Exactly. And then I was like, ooh, you know, maybe my fiance is planning a surprise party. And that's why no one can come to my party. Like, not mine. Like, we were both hosting. But I'm like, maybe that's why people are backing out. But I was still, like, super upset about it. And then I got, like, kind of low and depressed about it because I'm like, you know, people aren't realizing how big of a deal this is, and I'm still waiting for lungs, and the reality of it is I could die before I get these lungs, because every 3 days, someone dies waiting on the transplant list, not just for lungs, but any organ, and that's within Canada. So, you know, and again, it's one of those, it's my life experience that I'm living. Everybody else's life was going on as normal, and yeah, people checked in, and people hung out, and they saw how sick I was, but there was nothing anyone else could do for me. And I think that was probably the hardest struggle for my family and friends, as my support group was, they couldn't do anything to help, really. I mean, they showed up, they entertained me, they brought food, they did, like, you know, you can help, but there wasn't anything they could do to take like the struggle away. So this was Sunday morning, still laying in bed around 10 o'clock, like the phone rings, and I was like, ha, what if? And I answer, and it was this lady was like, hi, I'm just calling on behalf of like Trillium Gift of Life. So we may have lungs available for you. And I just like looked over at my fiance and I was like, oh my gosh. Like, I'm like, so, okay, what do I do? Like, when do I have to be there? Like, what is that? Like, oh my gosh. Right. So my mood went from like -100 to like +1,000. I was like, oh my gosh. And then I was like, thankfully did not have a party last night, because usually my birthday was like the one day a year where the team was like, yeah, you can have a drink if you want, because while you're listed, you can't have alcohol in your system. You get a call, you can't go into surgery.
Oh my God.
And I would have been exhausted having entertained and socialized all night, like an afternoon. So it was funny. I was like, oh, thank God we didn't have that party yesterday. And Eric was like, yeah, you can stop moping about that now, like joking around. But so she's calling. She said, okay, the donor will be going into surgery later this afternoon. So if you can be in Toronto by tonight, say like 7:30, and surgery will be scheduled for the morning. So I hung up from that, and I was just like, oh my gosh, like we were literally laying in bed debating where we were going to go and get brunch. And I was like, all mopey, like, I don't even really want to go anywhere. It doesn't matter. Like my birthday's not important. Like, and then I was like super pumped. So my parents had actually left on the Thursday to drive out to our cottage in New Brunswick, because we have family out there. So we have a place. So I hung up from there and I call my mom, and she answers the phone with, I have not even been gone 3 whole days. What could you possibly need? Because her and dad were so excited to get away. They're like, don't bug us. Give us a break. And I was like, guess what? Like, Tara, I don't know. Like, what? And I'm like, no, no, no. Guess what? And she's just, it's like silence. And then she goes, no way. And I'm like, oh, yes way. And she's like, no way. And then I'm like, okay, just so we're clear, we're talking about lungs here. And she goes, yeah. Like, so they're in New Brunswick, you know, a little far away.
Yeah. Not Toronto.
And because we had had the false call, we were then like, okay, like, what do we do? Are you going to come like drive straight through with dad? Are you not? And then they were like, well, if we drive through, it's like an 18-hour drive. Like, what if we're driving and like we don't get there in time, or like we don't even know? Like, so they were like, okay, let's wait till the donor is out of surgery and like they for sure need you in Toronto tonight. So mom and dad were looking at flights to get to Toronto, because it's only like a 3-hour flight, pit stops in Ottawa and you're good to go. So my mom got one of the last tickets out of Moncton that Sunday. Again, of course, it's a Sunday. On a plane, and she made it to Toronto late Sunday night. My fiance and I drove up to the hospital together. I had a family friend who lives in Woodstock, but she was actually in Sarnia visiting her parents, and like I called her and I'm like, I'm not spreading that I got a call just yet, but I got a call, and like we were freaking out because basically we grew up as sisters. Our parents were close friends, and she came over and like French braided my hair for me, and like we
because
hung
at
out.
This point you can't, because you're so sick and moving.
Oh, no. And it was one of those things I learned from the first time around, because I had just ended up throwing my hair in like a ponytail bun at the back of my head to get it out of the way. And after I got out of hospital, it was like rat's nest that literally my hair came out in like a clump and I had a bald spot from it. So I was like, fun fact, I should like braid it back instead next time. So I was a little more prepared. I had learned the tricks of the trade. But we got to the hospital and it was kind of exciting, but we were all a little like hesitant too, knowing it could be a false call and everything. So they were saying the surgery for the donor, went well. It's looking like we're on schedule for surgery. So I was there. My sister was home from school. She goes to Queens and Kingston. So she drove to Toronto, and I am pretty sure she was in the middle of like her work term, or like, cause she's in the engineering program, but it's a 5-year one where it goes like all the way through. And so like she made it there. My other sister made it from Sarnia, and then my half sister from Buffalo, New York, she made it. Like, and so we were like, oh, we got this set. We know what hospital we're at. We know what hotel we're staying at. Like, we've done this, we're good. And then my uncle and my cousin drove up as well. Two of my friends were there, and we all just kind of hung out in this room, and you're just waiting to get updates and stuff. So then the nurse came in, she's like, all right, like I need you to go and shower down with this special like cleaner stuff to make sure you're sterile for like surgery and stuff like that. So I did that, and then you know we're all hanging out like kind of cracking jokes and having fun, but it's also like, you know, very intense. And over the 4-year span of rejection and going to Toronto all the time, I had started staying at my friend that I met in Guelph. I lived with him in residence. I went to stay at his parents' place because they live in Etobicoke when I visited in the summer. And then his mom's like, oh, come back anytime you want. And like, this was before I was going super regular. And I was like, oh, thanks. Like, don't have to stay in a hotel. Great. Well, then I was going like at least once a month. So then the joke was that I became their new adopted kid because I was home more than my friend Dave was from Guelph. Like, so they basically adopted me into the family. So him and his sister were there like with me as well. And we're all waiting. And it was just like super exciting. And it just goes to show like how important having a support group is. I kept joking with the nurses and stuff like that, because they, you know, they're always checking your name, date of birth, all that. And I'm like, tomorrow, birthday's tomorrow. And I'm like, and it's my 25th birthday tomorrow. But then I got like, I was so pumped. And then I got to the point of like, okay, let's be practical here. I'm like, what are the odds that I have this like movie worthy story of I get my lungs on my 25th birthday? Like, there is no way. Like, so I was kind of, you know, prepping myself in case it didn't go through. So my dad was still in New Brunswick, and his plan was he was going to drive to Toronto or get on a flight the next day. So part of me was also like, well, I can't like go into surgery if my dad's not here. Like, cause like, I mean, when you're being wheeled in, it's almost kind of like you're saying goodbye to people and you're hoping you come off of the table and get to see them again kind of thing. But I got taken down into the OR waiting area just before 8 a.m. on my birthday. And like, same thing, all the nurses, doctors, surgeon, all the prep people keep be like, name, date of birth. And I'm like, Tara Burke, and it's today. I'm 25. It's today. Like, and they're all like, no way, this is a perfect story. Like, this is amazing. And I'm like, stop, you're gonna jinx it. Like, don't say anything. And then my surgeon came down and was like, things are a go. So like, we'll give you a couple minutes with everybody and then we'll wheel you in. So that was when everybody got all emotional and they're like, oh my God, it's actually happening. Hugs, crying, exciting. I FaceTimed my dad, which was super weird to be like, good luck with surgery, kid. Like, and then I'm like, I just giving you a hug through the phone. Like it was weird. I'm like, and if that's the last conversation I have with my dad and it was over FaceTime, like I was kind of bummed. And I joked with him. I'm like, I bet if you had shown up at the airport with mom yesterday and you said, my daughter is getting lungs, someone would have given you their ticket. Like, how unique is that story?
He would have come because there like wasn't a seat available.
Yeah, my mom got the last
flight. Had to choose.
Oh yeah, with timing. And it made sense that like my mom is a very anxious person and worrier to begin with. And if she had had to stay in New Brunswick by herself and not be in the hospital, that would not have gone well. So yeah, dad, like, and he said, he's like, I have a flight booked. I will be there by the time you're out of surgery. Like, I'll see you then kind of thing.
He must've been losing his mind the entire, everything.
I bet. So, and then the funny part is that, so my sister filmed me being like wheeled into the OR. And I was like waving and I'm like, see ya suckers, hard part starts for you. Like I get to go to sleep now and you guys have to do all the waiting and the anxious stuff. Whereas I'd been doing it for 4 years at that point. And so the surgery was like 14 and a half hours. It just took a lot longer with scar tissue and everything like that. And I found out like months after the fact that the nurses had messed up and they hadn't really updated my family throughout the day. So like after the normal amount of time had passed, my family was getting concerned and worried that things weren't going well. And then I also ended up in a coma for 4 or 5 days afterwards that I obviously have no recollection of. But so what happened essentially was they were overdosing me on sedation and pain meds. So I wasn't quite coming to. Plus, a major surgery, it sometimes takes a little while, but it had gotten to the point where they were concerned that I had had a stroke on the table and I might have become a vegetable and was not waking up. So that was stressful. And then when I found this all out, I felt bad for being like, see ya suckers, hard part starts for you. And then I go and stay in a coma. So recovery wise though, in hospital, I was not in as much pain. But because I was in the coma and all the medications and surgery and everything, I ended up having a psychotic break and I basically went crazy and I had to be put on a medication to help with that. But I was seeing things like incredibly detailed. I was convinced at one point that there were mannequins everywhere in my room.
Oh God, that would be so scary.
It wasn't scary for me because it was my neighbor, my roommate, like you're in ICU, you don't have a roommate. She has cancer. And she's just practicing doing makeup and hair on all these mannequins for herself because she has to shave her hair and she's not going to have eyebrows. Like, so there was logic.
Yeah,
there was logic to it, but not really. Like one of my nurses, like I had told my parents like, oh yeah, we did like a whole Halloween haunted house for the nurse's daughter and it was her birthday. Like it was really cool. And my mom's like, this did not happen last night. Like, so I was on this medication. So, I mean, my family got a laugh out of it, which there's a lot of funny stories, like me on morphine to begin with is funny. Me in a psychotic break on morphine, even better. Another one, I was convinced that I kept seeing like a dog in my room, which my two dogs were at home. The hardest goodbye that I had to say, I feel bad saying it, and I even admitted it to my family, was to my dogs. Because I was like, they don't know what's happening. And if I never come home again, like mom just disappears. Like yeah, I was a sobbing mess. Like it would be like if I had a kid and it was a baby. They don't understand. Like I was like, at least you guys know what's happening. So my nurse at one point was knelt down at the side of the bed and like his hair was sticking up. And I was like, oh my God, a dog. And I had pet his head. So, you know, it was fun. But recovery wise, everything went extremely well. I put 30 pounds on within 2 months without trying. So I had a feed tube put in while I was waiting for lungs that time because I finally gave up and was like, I cannot physically eat anymore in a day. So that I had the feed tube, but we weren't doing feeds really. I was just eating and living normally, doing my workout 3 days a week at the hospital and going to clinic. And I put weight on so quickly, not burning it with my crappy lungs, that I got shin splints. So I literally got to be too heavy for my body to support. So I had to be taken off of treadmill and they're like, just sit on the stationary bike and
best do that. Problem ever.
Oh yeah, but they were like, they did x-rays to make sure there weren't like, my shin bone hadn't like shattered or anything like that. Like, they were concerned there was something wrong. No, I just got fat quick. And by fat, I mean for myself, fat.
Normal
you go
size.
From, yeah, I am normal now. And I, like, people look at me and they're like, oh, you're still tiny. And I'm like, I have 4 or 5 pounds on, man. Like, this is, I have flub and I love it. Like, like, I'll put pants on. I'm like, oh, these are too small now. And I'm like, they're too small now. Woohoo. Like,
so
it's
good.
About to be annoying now that I work and I'm a real adult because I'm tired of having to buy new pants every few months.
But it is inconvenient.
Yeah. You know, but, like, and we thought the first transplant had initially gone really well. This one went way better. Like, even my doctors and stuff had said, you know, you waited so long because we found like a perfect match. It was like, it looks good. And at this point, the doctors are basically family. Like, I had invited some of them to my wedding because that's how close we were. So, and another unique thing about my second transplant was that just before I hit the 3 month mark, or just after, I received a letter from the donor family, which I hadn't the first time. So the way that it works with privacy laws and everything like that is you can write a letter. It has to be fairly anonymous, but you can write to the donor family and say, you know, I received lungs and I'm very thankful for this. And I had to speak like, I am a young female in university, like university age, or like be very like non-descriptive, but share your story essentially if you wanted to. Which was very hard for me because I had created the Facebook page and I was very big on advocating and sharing my story. And the first time around, I wrote to my donor family and I only created the page so that people didn't have to add my dad on Facebook for updates because that's how he updated people for the first surgery. So I hadn't even thought about writing to this family yet. Like, they recommend you wait till you're at least a year so that you have time to actually, like, you know, get out of the hospital and settle in. But because I'd already had a transplant, you know, I was probably going to write sooner. But I received a letter from the family, which was, like, for me, it was super emotional, but I was so excited because I, like, I wish the first family had reached out to me in response to my letters. And I've sent off a few, you know, updates over the years and stuff. But I also completely understand how maybe just receiving those letters is good closure for them, and, or even, you know, satisfaction of, hey, this person's still alive and doing things and they don't necessarily need to put a face to, you know, the loss of their loved one. So I completely understand that, but receiving this one, and it was the mother who wrote it, and it was in a nice little card, and she basically, you know, described her son as a young male who, you know, enjoyed hockey and liked working on cars and was always helping the neighbors, shoveling, raking, you know, we had like, I love hockey as well. So we had a few things in common. But it was kind of interesting to just have a bit of that connection and almost more of a, like an awareness or like a sense of purpose of like, these lungs were gifted to me and they were from some young person that passed away. And I'm a young person that was sick and I got these lungs so that I can continue living and stuff like that. So I do try and keep that in mind. Like, every day I'm definitely very thankful for the fact that I'm breathing and I'm able to get up and move. But I also, there's a balance between living for your donor family and just living your life, because a lot of people end up with, you know, kind of this obsession with, you know, I have someone else's lungs. I need to excel. I need to be amazing. I need to become the prime minister. Like, and you have to live your life and, you know, do your thing. So at my, I don't remember how far out it was, but I did write a letter back to the family saying, you know, I'm a young female. Like, this is where I'm at in my life. I've been able to start working a full-time job for the first time ever, outside of nannying that I had done before, which is a full-time job, but I was like, this is an adult job. Like, I work at a bank now. Like, I get dressed fancy and I go to work. Like, you know, I was planning my wedding. I was, you know, able to actually sit back and really envision a future of, you know, I'm going to be having kids. I'm going to be alive for much longer, whereas I grew up with CF thinking, you know, most of us are dead by the time you're 30, unfortunately. So it's such a weird shift in your mindset. But it was awesome to get that letter from the mom and say how, so it sounded like it was a full body donation. I was one of four recipients, and I was surprised she wrote as soon as she did, but I was also really proud of her for doing it. Like, I don't know this woman, but I was just like, you are amazing. And the fact that you wanted to reach out and say, like, you are grateful to know that I'm doing well, I've recovered and I'm out of hospital. Again, they can only get a little bit of information. So I'm hopeful that maybe they receive my letter. So if I accept their letter and I write an anonymous one and they accept it, then you can kind of bypass the privacy law of you both have given consent to be in contact. And I have a few friends who have met their donor family. And it's such an incredible bond, and it is something so unique and different that I think I would like it. It would be very weird at first, but I think because it sounds like we were similar in age and stuff like that, that it might be, you know, kind of neat to see their son helping somebody be able to live life when an unfortunate event happened that they lost their son. So my big thing when I give speeches and stuff is I say, you know, the one thing that's guaranteed in life is that you're going to die. Everybody dies. And it does not matter how old you are, how young you are, if you have a pre-existing health condition, if you are a registered donor, you can still impact somebody else's life and you can give them years of life that they would not have had. They would be dead. That is why you get a transplant when you are so sick that you will not live much longer. So when you don't need it anymore, why not pass it on and kind of leave that legacy and essentially become someone else's hero and literal lifesaver? So it's hard to put into words like how grateful and thankful I am for both of my donors. And I hope that because I am public with my story and stuff, if my first donor family found me and it has been silently following along, I hope that they don't feel bad about the fact that the lungs rejected, because I still got 6.5 years out of that first set of lungs that I would not have had. I had been told that I would be lucky to make it to my 19th birthday in July when I listed the end of January. So I was able to do so many things in those 6.5 years. Yes, I spent a lot of it on the couch and sleeping and being sick, but on my good days, I was able to go out and actually live my life and do things. And, you know, even if the lungs only lasted 2 years for someone, those are still 2 years of a quality of life and an ability to function that, like, I could have never imagined or dreamed up before, because I knew no different. And you knew how to function with your ailing body because you're used to having cystic fibrosis. So it's just so incredible that science is able to do that and people are willing to donate. And now it's just the push of, they're not using donor cards anymore in Ontario. So people that have them in their wallets or whatever, they're not valid anymore. It's all online, beadonor.ca. You take your health card and you register online. Or when you get your new license, they still send out the mail-in paperwork or at Service Ontario kind of thing. And then if you go to the beadonor.ca and you're from a different province or whatever, there are other links there on how to register within your province. And they're starting to simplify the process to get people to register. And then the most important thing is once you register, talk about it. Because at the end of the day, your next of kin, your family, has final say as to whether you donate your organs or not. And if the doctor comes forward to you and they say, hey, you know, Eric, unfortunately, there's nothing left we can do for Erica. We've tried our best. You were in a fatal accident. You know, she's brain dead. She was registered as an organ donor and is a good candidate for it, but it is up to you to decide whether to proceed with this because they have to make all of your decisions for you. So a lot of the times, you know, if you are registered, the family goes for it because you have expressed your wishes. But if it's something you never mentioned or talked about, it might be a harder decision. They're going, oh, did they register at 16 and then never think about it again? Or, you know, something like that. So there's a lot of, you know, and it's a hard time and a lot of emotions and everything for the family. So it's easier if it's a conversation you've already had, which you can look at it as a morbid conversation of, you know, if I'm dead, donate my organs. Or you can look at it as like, you know, hey, I want to do something with my life and my body once I no longer need my organs, because your organs don't age the same that your body ages. Like the oldest donor was 98 and they donated their kidneys. Like there's no age limit. There's no restrictions. And the way with medicine is going, even if you're someone, say that, like, if I were to pass away from, say, some freak accident, technically my lungs could be redonated because they are healthy individual lungs. Not many people would want like my pancreas or liver because they're impacted with CF. But if mine was in great condition and like a worst case scenario, there was another CF patient who had maybe 24 hours to live, they could potentially give like my liver to someone. Like it's, I'd leave it up to the experts on that is my biggest opinion. And it doesn't have to be a morbid conversation of, you know, death being a bad thing. Like having faced it at 18 years old, I'm like, it's something that happens and you see, you know, unfortunate, tragic accidents all the time, or, you know, someone just passes away in their sleep and there's no explanation. And if you could donate, even if there's people that still want to have, you know, open casket, or they're worried, like they won't look like my kid anymore. They perform surgery on a donor the same as they do a live person. So even if like you're donating tissue, which was one of my questions too, I'm like, so you're literally going to take some of my skin? So of course you go to like Halloween movies where like they peel people's faces. Like, I'm like, how do you do that? They're like, no, no, no. Like we go like behind your thigh and we take like a 5 centimeter piece, because then they can take that and add cells to it from the recipient and it grows in a lab. Like, so it's not like shaving your skin off. That was what I was picturing. And I even asked like about your eyes, like if you donate your corneas, I'm like, but they're my eyes. Like, isn't that weird? And they're like, it's not the coloring of your eyes. It's just the top layer of it, almost like a contact layer that just allows someone else to see.
So interesting.
So I like when I'm speaking with people and I'm like, ask me questions, because I had all the same questions and I was hesitant to register as a full donor as well, because I'm like, I don't want to donate my skin and you like shave skin off. Like, how does that work? Like, so, and it just, you know, obviously I'm living proof that it works. And even if I only end up living for, say, since the first transplant, another 10 years, like I didn't die at 18 years old. Mm-hmm. So I find that, and even if it is someone who is 65 or 75, however old they are and they've received it, you're giving them more time with their family and their friends and their grandkids and just to be around, and you're living with a different appreciation of life. Like there are little things that, you know, you get really excited about. Like when I was nannying and I started with a new family and they had a trampoline, I was way more excited than the kids were to play on the trampoline every day, because I'm like, look at me, I can jump, I can breathe. Like,
I'm coming above my head.
Yeah, exactly. And the kids are kind of like, Miss Tara, like, what are you doing? But it's just little, like riding a bike again. Like I feel like I have the appreciation and the wonder of life of like a 4 or 5 year old, where just everything is amazing. Like, wow, mom, how did you do that? Like you're just able to do things with such an ease that it's just amazing.
Oh, when you talk, do you often make people cry?
I do sometimes. Yeah. I've talked about it enough that I don't cry anymore. But I do give like a disclaimer of like, if any of my family, friends, or like immediate family are coming to my speeches, like they're not allowed to sit in the front row anymore, because that happened once and they were all sobbing. And I was just like, guys, like you're going to make me cry. Cause I cry if I see other people cry.
Yeah.
So my trick, especially if it's an in-person speech, is I don't wear my glasses, because my distance vision is a little off because of prednisone. So I can't quite make out full facial expression. Perfect. I can't see them crying, but I do try and like, you know, make eye contact. And when I'm talking, like I like to add jokes into it because I want it to be a lighthearted, you know, experience. And I'm sharing my story. And like, as a toddler, I was tubby. I was fat. I was Tubby Tara. Like that's my name. So I joke that now I'm like, this is Tubby Tara 2.0. Like I'm coming back. Like, and I try and get people involved and laughing, because you know, it doesn't have to be a discussion that is so sad and depressing. And I find just, you know, in North America, we have such a negative view of death. Whereas if you go more towards like the Western world where they're like, it's just part of life and you go through the process, and some of them believe you start another life, like whatever you believe about afterlife, after death, good for you. But it's one thing that is going to happen. So you may as well talk about it and make some good come of it.
I love that so much. Now, if people want to follow your journey online, where can they go? Because I know you have Facebook, Instagram. Mm-hmm. People know where they can hunt you down.
Yeah, I'm all over it. Actually, I haven't been as active in the quarantine because there's not a whole lot to share. COVID, it's been fun. But I am on Facebook. I have a Facebook page called Alive With Every Breath. And then I have my Twitter and my Instagram linked to that page as well. My Instagram is TBRQ, so Tara Burke basically without my vowels. and then
yeah, I was always,
It looks, I don't know, I like how it looks and I've just stuck with it.
I've always wondered, and I was meant to ask you, I was like, what is, I didn't want hard enough to piece it together.
No, I mean, it just, it is. And sometimes there's no meaning to some people's names, so.
I love it.
And then on Twitter, I am TARRABRQ.
Okay, so got it.
I'll they're all a little this, different. Yeah those are all linked. They're all linked. Like I have my Facebook page is like the link on my Instagram page. And then I'm not on Twitter. I find I go through phases with Twitter.
Yeah.
But if that's how people want to reach out, like I am an open book and I do enjoy sharing things. And, you know, I share like regular life funny things, and then like out of nowhere there'll be this like novel of a post that you know I made a note on my phone one day when I was just like having a moment or like I couldn't fall asleep, and then a few weeks later I'll be like, yeah, I think I should share that, like there's a good message in it. And that's what I do. So well,
it was so good your Facebook page though, because that was how when you had your second surgery, that was again your random online stalker. That was how I checked in to see how you were doing, because you had friends and family updating it.
And that was
how you were doing. And so there's a lot of good stuff. If you guys want to look back, I'm assuming it's all still saved.
Oh yeah. Yeah. It's all there. And like on the, that's why I made it a page versus just my profile and everything. Because obviously, and then the older I get, I'm like, I don't want to have a bunch of random people that I don't know on my Facebook and, you know, sharing like important family memories and stuff like that. But the page is easier to navigate. Like you can click on the side, like you can separate it by year or look for specific posts. And then sometimes I share old posts again and I'm like, I can't believe how far I've come. Mm-hmm. Or reading it, I'm like, wow, old Tara had really good insight. Like, where has that gone? Like today I'm struggling because I didn't have a coffee. Like, so it almost is like, I've had a few people approach me and say like, you really should write a book. And I just don't know where to start with it, but I guess I can start with taking all of those posts and throwing them together and kind of seeing where it goes. And, you know, I said that should have been my quarantine project, but then it was like, it's an excuse to do nothing. So I've done a lot of Netflix, but, I think it'll be something that I do eventually. My pediatric doctor, his son, who is now also a doctor, has published 2 books and he's writing a third, and he's asked me to like proofread a draft of it. So I'm like, okay, if you can write a book and you're a doctor and you have 4 kids and like as if you had free time, he can give me like tips and tricks on how to get started and do things. So it's one of those, like I've made it a life goal to maybe try and assemble. And it's also just weird for me to think, you know, my life story is interesting to people. Like it's like if I were to say to you like, hey, tell me what's happened in your life from JK to now. And then I, at the end of it, I'm like, you're an inspiration. You're so amazing. I love it. You should write a book. And you're like, that's just my life. Like, that's what I did. Like I didn't have another choice. But now that I'm healthy and able to kind of step aside from that, and I'm learning how to be a healthy person and not be focused on being sick, I guess, and having to actually experience being an adult, you know, going to work to earn the money to pay the bills and things. I was like, I just wish I could do that. And now I'm like, oh, it's only Tuesday. Like, But then I go, yeah, it's only Tuesday. And I'm excited that I can complain about that. Like,
okay. So. Well, even doing this podcast, right? Like before you wouldn't have even had the breath or the energy.
Oh gosh, no. And I never would have booked it for in the morning. Like, meanwhile, I've already been up. I've been to an appointment. I'm ready for work. Like,
Insane. And yes, your life is addictingly interesting. And I feel a little bit creepy stalking you as much as I do.
Yeah. I think it's a unique life story for the fact that I'm 27 and have done a lot of things.
For me, it's the story that's interesting, but it's your outlook that keeps me. Mm-hmm. It's your perspective and it's your outlook on life and it's how you tackle the hard stuff is really inspirational. And as someone who's had to, you know, had essentially no challenge compared to what you've faced,
We all have our own, and I think.
Yeah, I know.
It hits us on the same level-ish, you know?
Different.
Yeah, but I think you can empathize, and yes. I think empathy is the biggest thing, and that's where I've learned, as I'm growing up, like, who is a real friend, who is understand, like, and I have found that the people with empathy were the biggest supports for me, because they're like, I have no idea what it's like. But one time I fell and broke my leg and it was awful wearing a cast. And I'm like, they're like, I feel bad comparing. And I'm like, no, like that is you sharing your life experience with me to try and relate and build a bond and share a story and have a conversation. Because I don't think you can share your life story, but then belittle someone else's because mine was harder than you. Or if you have that attitude too, you're almost entitled of like, the world owes me because mine was harder. But it's unfortunate, you know, roll of the dice that I have cystic fibrosis, but it's also awesome that I was born when I was, because had I been born 10, 20 years before that, I wouldn't have made it past like the age of 2. So medicine is improving. We're in a really great time for science. There's new medications out that are actually working on the faulty gene to like almost band-aid it and make it work proper. So it's just fascinating and it's crazy. And I will partake in any study possible and whether it impacts myself or not, just to see where things are going and how it's changing. And it gives you a bit more of a grateful feeling for how far you have come and trying to make the most out of living day by day, but also planning ahead and hoping for a future and starting a retirement savings, which is something I never thought I'd be doing. So...
So cool. I love that. Ooh. Well, thank you so much. I so appreciate it. And beadonor.ca, right?
Yep.
Go check it out. It takes 2 minutes and have those difficult conversations with your family. Thank you so much, Tara. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
That's a wrap, guys. Thank you so much for listening to this week's episode. I'm going to remind you that if you are in Ontario, please, please, please go check out beadonor.ca. If you're in Canada, it has all the links to the various places based on province where you can sign up. And if you're outside Canada, please go and Google Become a Donor, because in Ontario, and I'm sure all the places across the world, they're setting up the system. So they're online and digital now so that they're super easy and takes no time. I'm not even kidding you. I've wanted to be an organ donor for years and years and years, to the point where I only didn't sign up because I thought it would be a long process, and I just figured I would just tell my family that I wanted to be an organ donor, and that was enough. But I finally signed up after recording this episode with Tara, and I'm not even kidding you, my computer froze in the middle of it and still only took me 90 seconds. I just needed to grab my health card and that was it. So if you have a free moment and you are interested in being an organ donor, it is a wonderful gift that you can give. Thank you guys so much for listening. Have a fantastic day.